Okay, here we go. Right, good morning everybody. Thank you for having me. It's a real honour to be here, especially when I see my antecedents in previous sessions of the Torah Way and my successors as well. So I hope I can hold my own at least for today in this distinguished company. I must also say a special hello to anybody listening online or on the phone at any time from my wonderful community in Mobile Hill. There are fantastic people out there, so a special hello to any of you out there who are listening to this. The title of the talk is The Wonderful World of 11. And I chose this because Shvat is the 11th month in the Jewish year. Nisan is Rosh Chodeshim, so here we are at number 11. And 11 doesn't get much of a looking in the Torah. We get lots of 7s and 10s and 5s and 2s, 3s, but not many 11s. And yet here we are, today, on Tu Bishvat, celebrating something to do with 11, it being the middle of the 11th month, just today. We see that there are other distinguished Chagim that fall on the 15th of the month. We've got Pesach, we've got Sukkot, we've got Shushan Purim, all on the 15th. And there's obviously something about the 15th of the month which is very significant, and we'll return to that later, all being well. But I wanted to focus on this idea of 11 and see where it takes us. Before talking about the significance of Shvat as the 11th month, I'd like to have a quick tour through 11s in the Torah. And there are several. The first one is the 11 stars in Yosef's dream, when he's dreaming about his brothers, and he tells his brothers, the beginning of Yeshua, behold the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me. And this, of course, being the first mention of 11 in the Torah, is the seminal one. It's the definitive 11. So when we think about stars in the sky, that tells us something about every single 11 in the Torah. Again, why might this be? What's so special about 11? And what's he got to do with stars? This is all stuff that we need to find out about. The next 11 that we come across is in the Mishkan. We know that the Mishkan was made of boards that made up the walls, and draped over these boards there were lengths of different kinds of cloth. The first layer of cloth was made of 5 long strips linked to another 5 long strips by golden hooks that made 10 altogether. On top of that section of 10 cloths, there was a second layer of 11 cloths. The goat skins that were draped as a second layer on top of the Mishkan, there were 11 of them. One section of 5 and one of 6. Again, we have 11 right there in the middle of one of the most important aspects of the Torah. And the Mishkan features another 11 still, the 11 of the Keteret. The incense that that was burned every day in the Mishkan and that the Kohen Gadol took into the Kodesh Kodashim on Yom Kippur was made up of 11 ingredients. So here we are again, hitting 11. And at the beginning of Devarim, we have 11 yet again, where it says that Moshe began to teach Torah to the Jewish people at the beginning of the 11th month. And it was 11 days away from Hasina. So looking at the Torah through a perspective of 11, we find there's actually quite a lot there. And here we are, Tu Bishvat, which is the height of the 11th month. So what's going on today? And of course, some of you may well have already celebrated by eating fruit. That's what we do on Tu Bishvat. The main minhag of the day is to eat 15 fruit. What's the 15 fruit got to do with the 11th through the Torah and the 11th of Shvat? As it happens, there is a sefer which touches on the significance of many numbers in the Torah, and it talks about 11 as well. It's called Bereichos B'Cheshbon, and if you haven't read it yet, I strongly recommend you do, by Rav Shimshon David Pinkus Zatzal. And what he does is, in this fascinating book, he goes through Echad Miyodea from the end of the Seder, and he goes through all the numbers in Echad Miyodea, and he shows why each one is related to the thing that's with it. Echad is Hashem Bashmaim of Oretz, and Shnei Lochet Abris, Shlesha Ovid, Abba Imais, and so on. And he shows why there is something intrinsic to each of these numbers related to the object that it's referred to. And he talks about numbers generally beyond the context of Echad Miyadea, using Echad Miyadea as a form of illumination for the intrinsic nature of each number. And he talks about 11 as well, because 11 is in there. Achad Asar Kosh Vayod, the 11 stars of Yosef's dream, that seminal mention of the stars, comes out in Echad Miyadea as well. I'm going to labour the next point, because it is the most important point, and if you get this, you got the rest. If you miss this point, that would be a little bit awkward. So I'm going to try to make this point extremely clearly. If I seem to be getting redundant, just please move me on, tell me it's enough already. We know, of course, that Ikas Kinabatah Tolim, the Almighty chooses to reside, when at all possible, down in this world. We see that, for example, in Gan Eden, Hashem was Mithalef Bargon Neruach Hayon. He was walking around, strolling around in the garden. The hishalech is not going with any particular end in view. It's just to stroll along, to hang around. And that's what Hashem was doing in Gan Eden, in this perfect position before the hate of Adam Rishon became apparent. Again, at Matan Torah, when the Torah was given, Hashem was said, "Bayeh Hashem HaSinai." Hashem came down onto the mountain to give the Torah to the Jewish people. It doesn't just mean that physically there was an impression of Hashem on the mountain, a revelation of Hashem. Rather, it means that Hashem's Shekhinah became once again imminent in the world. There was something approaching pantheism, but not quite, when Hashem came right down into the world to be joined intimately with it. And similarly, in Baruch Kaisai, one of the brachos that Hashem promises to us is the Hishalachti B'Soichachem. That Hashem will once again, when we have worked the world out and made everything okay, the Tzakein Olam HaMalchus Shakai, when everything's alright one day, then Hashem will be once again strolling along with us. And this is because Ikar Shekhinah B'Tachton, the Almighty desires to reside down in the world with us. 10 is a symbol of the world itself. It's a symbol of the ultimate completeness. Beyond 7, which is the integration of Ruchnis Agashis, the spiritual and the material, 10 is an idea of everything together, all working in harmony. We have the 10 Makos as the revelation of Hashem's Din. We have the Asara Dibra, the Aseret HaDibra, the 10 Commandments. And when we have 10, that's a very good thing. It's an idea of Hashem interacting with the world so imminently that he's almost indistinguishable from it. He and the world are wrapped up tightly together. This, for example, is what we saw with the ten Makos, the 10 plagues in Egypt, where Hashem was so imminent in the world that even Paran had to recognize him ultimately. He just couldn't hear it. First of all, he said, "Mi Hashem Hashem." Who's this Hashem thing? Towards the end of the Makos, he says, "Hashem HaTzadik Vani Vami Arashoyim." Paran had this recognition that Hashem is in charge of the world, because he was there before his eyes. That's 10. 10 is Hashem in the world, so that wherever you look, you can't miss him. 11 is different. 11 is much worse than that. 11 is where the world has gone a bit askew. When the world is being used not as a good context for Hashem, but as an evil context which Chas v'Shalom drives him away. And we see that when there is an 11, what this means is there is a dislocation of Hashem from this world. Hashem is taken a little bit out of it. Of course Hashem is still here in the world. He has to be here all the time to give chiyus to the world. If Hashem wasn't here for a moment, there'd be nothing. Hukas Mavarit Hashem. We see that Hashem is an ongoing life-giving force within the world. And even so that we can do evil, even so that we have that option to do evil, Hashem needs to be here to give us that opportunity. That's what Tomer Devorah says. Hashem gives us the opportunity to do bad things, and he keeps us alive to do that. Of course, that's not the point. The point is to do good things, don't get me wrong. But Hashem's life-giving force is with us all the time. It's just that in the context of evil, that life-giving force is removed slightly from the world, so that Hashem and the world become distinguishable. You have the world, which is 10, and Hashem distinct from it. 10 plus 1 makes 11. Now then, we live in an 11 world. That's where we are right now. The world, unfortunately, is lots of bad things go on. You know, we I don't know if anyone's listening to the radio this morning, there was this account of the most horrific cruelty meted out by British soldiers on Iraqi teenagers in Iraq. And more horrific still than what was going on was the commentary to it, where you have somebody which was really, I don't recommend you listen to it, but if you did have the misfortune to hear it, you hear Amalek. It was a glorying and a revelling in cruelty and might, and it was an appalling thing. We live in a world of 11. That's just this morning. I happened to hear it on the way here. It's on the radio, for goodness sake. We're living in an 11 world. Our job, specifically as Jewish people, as you've seen, have Torah, Pasha, Torah, is to counter this and to reintegrate Hashem into the world. A korban that we say every morning, the idea of drawing close, bringing Hashem back down into the world. Our tefillahs or something like that. The tefillahs represent and replace to a certain extent a kavanah. And we see that this reintegration work of bringing the 11 back down to 10 and teasing out the good in an 11 world, this is the job of Jewish people, and it comes out in each of the 11s in the Torah. And if we understand how these 11s in the Torah work, we can also understand this month of Shvat, and specifically our work today on Tu B'Shvat. So let's start off with the first 11, Achav Asokhev Vayah. The 11 stars in Yosef's dream. He sees 11 stars, and presumably to be able to see a star, they were against a background of darkness. That's how you can see it. In the day you can't see the stars at all. So he saw darkness, points of light against the darkness. And what happened to these 11 points of light against the darkness? They became completely light. Because the brothers initially, they had this potential for good, but it was all being used in the wrong way. It was being used to persecute their brother. And towards the end of the story of Joseph and his brothers, wonderful things happened. Yehuda, who'd been in charge of selling Yosef, was able to say that he would step in and redeem Binyamin and sell himself into slavery rather than allowing another brother to be enslaved. He led the way into Shuva. And he became Yehuda Atal Yeduch Achecha. He became the one who would be, through his admission of guilt, he would be able to reintegrate his evil into goodness and tease out the good from within himself to become the first Baal Teshuva, and therefore the forerunner of Moshiach. So because Yehuda was able to tease out, and indirectly all the brothers were able to tease out the goodness from within themselves, they were able to unwrap the evil fetters that were constricting their rushing to spirituality and become all good. That's the star, the point of light against the darkness. It may look very dark, but there's a point of light there, and we can develop that light and make the world into a day, the day of Hashem. And we see that also with the 11 Uriahs over the Mishkan. The Uriahs symbolize Esau. And it seems odd to have Esav in the Mishkan. But again, the whole point of this 11 thing is to tease out the good from within bad. Esav is compared to a goat. He came out kuloi ka'aderes se'or, completely like a hairy robe. Se'or is linked to the word sa'ir, which means a goat, because the goat's very hairy. Esav lives on Har Seir. He lived on Goatsburg, Goat's Mountain. Someone's got to live there. And we have these 11 goatskins covering the Mishkan, protecting of all things the Torah. How can it be that Esav is there protecting Torah? And the answer is there is a certain goodness even within Esav that we need to tease out. What goodness was there within Esav? He was good at purple. He said to his father, Heich ma'atin es ha-melech v'esateved, how do we tithe straw and salt? So he understood the fine points of the Torah to be able to tease out difficult points. He could impress his father with it. He used it in the wrong way, tied the fist, hunting within his mouth. He was using the Torah to deceive, but he did have a Kerech of Torah within him. What we need to do is take the Kerech of Torah even from within Esav and use it in a good way. And that's why we have the 11, the dislocation of Hashem from the world, and the Uriahs remind us to integrate the 11 back into 10. There were 10 ureas underneath the 11 ureas. 10 in the first level, 11 in the second. We need to bring down the 11 down into a 10, and underneath that 11 and 10 is the Torah itself. That's our job. The Torah is what defines us, defines our people. And again, in the 11 ingredients of the Keteres, we see the Keteres coming into action for the first time on a large scale with Nodav and Avihu, where it kills. And again, with Korach and his men, Korach and Choladosai, Korach 250 henchmen take the Keteres and they all die. The 11 ingredients of the Torah brought death. They brought bad things into the world, but they can also bring good. The good within the Keteres needs to be teased out. That's the whole point. And therefore, it took an Aaron and a Kohen to stop the plague with that same Keteres. Because what we were saying was, the Keteres may be an 11, it may have the power to do harm, but it can also do good. And our job as Jews is to bring out the good from within the bad. That's the point of the Keteres. That's why the Keteres was the most refined avodah. That's why it was used on Yom Kippur in the Kodesh Kodashim. Because that's the whole point of Jews in the world, is to tease out the 10 and the 1 from within the 11. To reintegrate Hashem back into the world. And that's why in Zedekiah on Shabbos morning, right at the end of the Tfilos, we have Pitul HaKeteres. And some people say it every single morning. Because the idea is, according to Rav Hirsch, that it's not a sort of afterthought, it's not tacked on. By the time we've been through Shacharit and perhaps Musaf as well, depending on the day, we've got to a point where we can do the Keteres job, where we can bring the 11 and make it back into a 10. And that is our job, that's our role as a nation, we can't just ignore it. And what about the 11 at the beginning of Devarim? So Rosh Hashanah von Hirsch talks about this as well. He doesn't talk directly about the 11, but I think what he says ties in very neatly with it. He talks about the idea of Devarim, and this I think is brought out nicely by the English word for Devarim, Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy means a repetition. And a lot of people are concerned by the fact that many of the mitzvahs in Devarim have already been mentioned in other parts of the Torah. The whole Aseret HaDibros have already been mentioned in Yisrael. Why doesn't it even mention again in Voice Hanan? And there are many other mitzvahs on which you can ask these questions. Mitzvahs in Shemais and Vayikra and Migdol, why doesn't it even mention again in Devarim? So Rav Hirsch says that there is a particular rationale, and he traces this theme through, as to why certain mitzvahs are repeated in Devarim. He says that when the Jewish people were listening to Moshe in the desert towards the end of Moshe's life, they were about to undergo a major spiritual trauma. They were moving on from being people who were in an entirely spiritual environment to people who had to move into a physical environment. In the desert, they were living on the Mon. They had the Ananiah covered all around them. They had Be'er Miriam. And now they're going to go into a land where they have to do all different things. They'd have to plow. They'd have to sow. They'd have to reap. They'd have to weed. They'd have to knead dough. All these things they knew about theoretically from the mitzvahs. They'd never done this. It was a new experience for them. For some of them, they may have had a recollection of it from Mitzrayim, but certainly not as free people. And they were standing on this threshold of this new life. There is also an idea I've heard that where the mon is described, I think in the Halacha, as being like Meshad Hashonim. And Shad is a breast. It's the idea of somebody who is entirely dependent on a parent. And the Jewish people, when they had the mom, they were entirely dependent on Hashem. And now they're moving away from that into a world of Gashmias, a world of materialism. And this was a major threat to them. And Rav Hirsch says that if you look at all the mitzvahs that are reiterated and repeated in Devarim, the point is that these are mitzvahs that were threatened by their being in Israel, by there being in a new material context, where it would have been harder to keep these mitzvahs in the appropriate spirit. And therefore they had to be repeated to remind the Jewish people, even though you're now going into a land which is physical and you're going to be living in a way that superficially is indistinguishable from all the rest of the people in the world, notwithstanding, you have to keep the plot and keep the Torah. And if you're not used to keeping these mitzvahs in this material way, well, you've got to get used to it, because that's what the rest of your history is going to be all about. And therefore, of course, this moment, this juncture in our history, is replete with elan. Because as the Jewish people went into Eretz Yisrael, they were entering into a new era where their job would be henceforth to tease out the good from the bad, to bring out the ruchnius from the gashmius. That was going to be that point. That was going to be the whole induction into the land, with an induction into the world where they'd be bringing spirituality out of physicality. So again, to make this point clear one more, the common feature, the tanashava of all these 11, is that we have a situation that is largely godless, and we have to tease out the good from within it. 11 actually defines us as a people, and it's common to all these things that we talked about through the Torah. And here we are now on Tu Bishvat, the 15th day of the 11th month. So what's the 11 here? And for that matter, if we're going to have some special day in Shvat, why not let it be the 11th of the month? Make the less fruit to start with. So why do we have it on Tu Bishvat? Why the 15th? And I touched on this at the beginning, when we had the 15th of Pesach and Sukkot and Shushan Purim. And what are we talking about at 15 here? What's going on? So here's an idea that again Rav Hirsch talks about in his collected writings, and he says that we need to understand the role of the moon within the Torah. He says that, as we all know, the moon doesn't have any light of its own, rather it reflects the sun's light onto the world. And the Jewish people, of course, are compared to the moon. HaChodesh says Elohim, this renewal is yours, it says in point. Because we're compared to the moon, we have to do the same sort of thing as the moon. Just as the moon reflects the sun's light into the world, so the Jewish people have to reflect Hashem's light, the light of the Torah, into the social world, the rest of humanity. And he traces this pattern through with the different Hagim and shows how different Yomim Tovim are actually illustrated by the shape of the moon on that day. Take example, Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah, the moon is new. We're just starting out again on a new year. We're starting on a progression towards a better relationship with Hashem. So the moon, which represents us, is brand new. It's hardly there at all. It's just beginning. On Yom Kippur, we've moved on from that. We're approaching a situation where we are become much more close to Hashem, and we can therefore say that we're getting there nicely. So the moon is getting towards full. The high point of Tishrei, by the way, is not Yom Kippur, it's Sukkot. That's the time when we have the Tzelah Demehem Nusar, we are in Hashem's shadow, as it were, and the moon is full, because now we're receiving complete Shefa from Hashem. We've got there, we've made it on Sukkot, we're rehabilitated with Him. Simchat Torah, Shmini Atzeres, we're moving away from Hashem, and therefore that time of the month, towards the end of the month, the moon is waning, because our relationship with Hashem is in a certain way dying off as well, as we move away from Tishrei. So when you have the 15th of the month, what it means is we're receiving maximum light from Hashem and bringing that maximum light to the world. And that's why we have two Bishvat and not Ya'at Bishvat, not the 11th of Shvat. It's the 15th when the moon is at its height and when we are supposed to be receiving the maximum light from Hashem and passing it on to the world. Now then, I think we can understand a bit more now about eating fruit on Tu Bishvat. We have a Kabbalistic concept of the klipah, a peel. And when you encounter a klipah in Kabbalah, that's always a bad sign. You're encountering something wrong. A klipah is, to put it very generally and very basically, it's the base materialism. It's the wrong things. It's the stuff that gets in the way. And that surely is the 11 message again. When you have 11, what we're saying is that the world is interfering with Hashem. It's an olam, a thing that hides, like Lo Shulchan His Alei. It's a thing that gets in the way of Hashem. On Tu Bishvat, when, for example, we take an orange, Or even if we peel a grape, which has, it has an edible peel. But let's talk about the orange, it's simpler. Take an orange, the peel of an orange is not really edible. It may be b'doichak, b'hilchas mukta, but basically we don't eat the peel of the orange. On Tuvish Lat, we peel that orange. And what we're doing is, we've got this horrible thing, the orange peel, which you can't eat, and we're peeling it away, and we're finding the good fruit within. That is the message of an 11, where we have a horrible thing, and we peel it away and find the good thing within it. The brothers of Yosef found the good within the first of the Koyach of Tshuva. The Yerioth was showing how we can take the good of the bad, deceptive pupil of Esau and turn it into a good, protective pupil. The Keteret being turned around so that a harmful thing can become a good thing. And we symbolize and express this by peeling fruit and eating it on Tu Bishvat. At this time, when the month is at its height, what we're doing is we're expressing the message and the mission of 11. We're taking the bad thing away and finding the good, sweet thing within. That is all that we do on Tu Bishvat. And this, perhaps, is a deeper message and a deeper meaning when we eat fruit today. What we're doing is, again, we're expressing our mission as Jews in the world to peel away the bad and find the good within. And with every fruit that we do, that we eat, we're doing that very same thing. We're reminding ourselves and teaching ourselves about our job in the world. And that's what it boils down to. Finding the good within the bad. And of course, that off-quoted pasuk, Adam et Hasada, says in, I think in Shoftim, and this is a point that's very close to my heart, that people are compared to trees. Just like trees have fruit, so people have fruit. Just like trees have fruit with peel on, which doesn't taste good but has a sweet fruit within. Similarly, people sometimes do things, we generate fruit, which can seem very horrible, but in fact, if you could just poke around a little bit inside and peel away the rubbish and the nasty exterior, you'll find something really beautiful and sweet and precious within. And perhaps a deeper message on Tu Bishvat that we can take away for our whole lives, and not just on this day of Tu Bishvat, is that whenever we encounter a human being who seems to be all wrapped up in bad, what we need to do as Jews is to work with that person and tease out the good from within them. So, for example, I think of somebody whom I know who finds it very difficult to come to shul. And I asked this person once to make a special effort to come to make a familiar, and it was difficult, and this person came to shul. They found it very difficult, but they did it notwithstanding. That's teasing out the good. It's finding, it's revealing to this person that they have an ability to do something they didn't think was possible. I think about that loathsome person doing that ridiculous and disgusting voiceover on that thing that I referred to before, celebrating evil. Well, yes, there is a certain context in which we can celebrate the meeting out of justice. It shouldn't be in that context. But this person also, even such a person, has this koyach to show where things are wrong and to put them right. It was being misused. It was being used in the evil context, and of course our job is to tease it out and find out the good within it and use it in the appropriate way. This, I think, is a message of Tu Bishvat. According to this, I've got 30 odd seconds left, so I better finish by wishing you all a happy and of course a fruitful Tu Bishvat. Thank you very much.